series, we want to use five systems, variously selected from the schools of mythological tradition, as indicative of levels of mythology. Therefore, each one of our discussions will be more or less comparative, but will emphasize the group under which the lesson is titled. So this evening we are going to discuss in general Babylonian creation myths. In particular, however, we want to lay down the foundation for a certain comparative study of world mythology. And as this is the only lesson we have set aside for creation stories, we must skip around a bit and hope that you will have the patience to realize that we want to cover as large an area as possible. In the beginning, we want to have something to say about the creation myth as a phase of human thought and human research. Every nation of importance has attempted to describe the origin of itself and to trace into the remote past the foundations of its religious and cultural institutions. For the most part, we come across something that mythologists have not emphasized, but which we must pause to consider. And this is especially true in the Babylonian group, but almost equally obvious in many other systems. Namely, that our creation account is nearly always twofold. There are two distinct stories, usually in some conflict, and about which a great deal of reconciliation has been attempted. We know, for example, in the Babylonian, that we have two distinct layers or levels of creation myths, one comparatively ancient and the other comparatively recent. When I say comparatively recent, I mean probably not over 3,500 to 4,000 years old, the older group being of much earlier development. These groups are gradually reconciled and interpreted until they meet, but there is no basic essential meeting of original ideas. Why should this be true? Perhaps the answer lies in the fact that man is conscious of creation on two levels of existence. When you study the Vedas, or most of the sacred books of the ancient world, you realize that the authors were heavily indebted to the symbolism of generation, of human generation, and the development of their concepts of cosmogony. In the Eastern system, that practically the entire story of the formation of the universe is based upon the prenatal development of the human fetus. And in various ways, the development and unfoldment of the world is regarded as merely the cosmic equivalent of the unfolding of the human being. On this ground, therefore, creation is a physical thing, arising from physical processes and, to a measure, symbolized by the physical changes and modifications which accompany the creativity of growth. There is also a second line of creation thinking, and that is psychological. If man, observing around him, finds that other things were created by generation, he then searches within himself for his own origin and finds not a physical source, but a more or less mystical source, a transcendent source, lying within the locked treasure house of consciousness. Man searching for the origin of himself, therefore, passes gradually backwards through the conscious, subconscious, and finally to the unconscious strata of his own psychic organism. A man within himself experiences the elaborate mythology of creation quite differently from the form which he imposes upon the outside formation of things by material generation. Gradually, of course, he externalizes his own internal instincts, and he invests the generative processes with their psychological overtones. But certain conflicts remain. Also, the psychological creation is usually earlier and more profound than the physical creation, because man, possessing certain imaginative faculties within his own consciousness, is able to conceive of processes far more abstract than he can observe. Thus, internal conception is balanced against external observation, and we have a conceptual universe and an observed universe. And these polarities have existed throughout the study, the development of human thought. Man searching for beginning has always been more or less burdened with difficulty. It is very hard for the human mind to conceive the total absence of a created state. And so we are not surprised that some have taken the rather bold attitude that creation was the formation of something from nothing. This, however, was not a satisfactory interpretation. It did not meet the full need of the growing mind. It seemed wiser then, man speculating upon the mystery of life, to assume that prior to existence as it was conceivable to him, there was something. And in the Greek and in the Babylonian and in the Egyptian philosophies, efforts to determine this pre-existing eternal condition or something took on relations to elements. Some held that fire was the eternal element and the root of all things, and that everything came from fire. Others, like Thales, held water to be the sovereignty, and that everything came originally from water. There were some who claimed air to be the parent of all elements, and still others earth. But in the course of time, the belief in the parenthood of fire and the parenthood of water took domination over the other two elements, and nearly all philosophical systems have been based upon the belief that either fire or water was the primordial substance of the world. Now, isn't it rather interesting that two extreme elements should be thus contrasted, and that in many instances the universal theory was based upon a compromise or a relationship of these two, as is the alchemistical problem of the production of the stone, or the wise man's symbol, which was said by these alchemists to be the result of fire burning in water, and water feeding the flame of fire. Now, if by water we can conceive, as perhaps we should, the material generational concept of life, all life, all form, all worlds arising from a kind of amniotic fluid in space, we can have what might be termed man's generation concept, based upon things observed or noted in the physical world. Generation from fire, on the other hand, suggests a more attenuated and spiritous essence. Fire seems to imply the creation of things from an invisible sources rather than from visible ones. And through the study of these things, particularly in the light of more modern psychological thinking, fire seems to come to suggest the consideration of creation psychologically, or as emerging from the internal life consciousness of man himself. So a creation envisioned from man's psychic life is likely to be a fire creation, one envisioned more primitively from his material life may be a water creation. And we have these again carrying on through religion, where we have fire cults and water cults powerfully represented. The fire on the altar, the water of purification, became in turn and time the symbol of spirit and body, or soul and form, or the internal and the external life of man. So man conceived of the spiritual world of which he was a part, originating in fire, and the material world or universe which he inhabited, originating in water. And from the union of these, the spiritual and the material, he recognized the rise of his own psychic life, or the emergence of all compound natures, bodies, processes, which have become familiar to him. The Babylonians and peoples of this area have a number of very interesting contributions to make to the cosmological thinking of the world. At a comparatively early date, probably even before the time of Sargon, approximately 3800 B.C., we find the rise of a great Semite culture in the Babylonian area. We know that this culture will finally flower nearly a little more than 1,000 years later in the rise of Hammurabi and the integration of the great Babylonian Empire. Thus, we have many foreign elements to consider in the integration of their religious beliefs. But also, we must recognize that nearly all faiths in surrounding areas are indebted to the religions of Nineveh and Babylon, and that these later influenced Egypt, Greece, and Persia, and that altogether the great Akkad culture has made a very important a contribution to our Bible and to the general knowledge of religious matters in Christendom and in the Judaistic worlds. So these things become very intriguing and very important to us. And we will then start with the basic problem that we have to face in all creation accounts, and that is an approach to the state of existence prior to creation. What in the Babylonian concept preceded the great motions which produced the world? Actually and obviously, there could not be too much dogmatizing on this subject, for man has never been able to develop a complete exposition of the state of the universe prior to objectivity. Like nearly all ancient peoples, however, the Babylonians assumed a polarized existence in the sense that the state of things prior to creation would be measured by a state opposite to the created state. If there were worlds in creation, there were no worlds prior to creation. If there was a certain organization present in the manifested universe, it would be absent in the non-manifested. So that the prior condition was without the conditions which later emerged from it, but possessed the potential or the possibility of causing conditions to emerge from its own nature. Thus in the Babylonian, as in the Chaldean later and the early Kabbalistic, that which preceded being was no being, not an absence of existence, but an absence of definable manifestation. Eternity encloses, includes, possesses time. But time can never encompass eternity. Time exists within eternity. And when time fails or dies, eternity returns to its own manifestation. The same with being. All beings exist within a total state. This total state, being undifferentiated, is beyond analysis. Yet this state must precede all others and must ultimately survive all conditioned forms of existence. This total being must contain within itself all that is manifested during a process of creation. Yet it does not come into total manifestation in anything. For total being can become manifested only in total existence. And total existence is as inconceivable to us, as Sankaranathan points out, as total lack of existence. All manifestation and no manifestation cannot be distinguished because the human being is incapable of the experiences of totality, either plus or minus. Thus man lives in a condition of partial manifestations. He measures all things partially, not completely. The Babylonians attempted to differentiate the condition that preceded being, and they came to the same concept that was later to be enclosed or captured within the Chaldean oracles of the Zoroasters, namely the thrice deep darkness. Eternity as bis and abyss, as Bhimi calls it, nothing and all. Something infinitely profound, infinitely eternal and existing, yet containing no measuring or marks by means of which it can be explored, defined, or captured by the mind or even by the consciousness itself. How then do you suppose the concept came into being or came into existence? Almost certainly through man's contemplation of the mystery of sleep. In other words, he has an objective awareness, and he has a subjective state, which in normal cases he is unaware of. He passes from a state of objective function to a state of non-knowing. In infancy, he emerges from a state of non-knowing. In the senility of age or of advanced years, he may return gradually to the childishness and infancy of not knowing. So wherever man extends his extremities beyond the boundaries of his normal functions, he approaches not knowing. Now the Chaldean and Babylonian was perfectly justified in assuming that the knowing can come from the not knowing. because it does so with every infant that is born. Gradually, from a condition which seems to be the lack or absence of qualities, these qualities gradually manifest themselves. Again, searching in his own experience for the answer to these things, the individual perhaps experiences dreams in which from within himself he becomes aware of an internal world or life that is entirely separate from the external. And this internal life exists in a strange, dark, mysterious world which can be entered only through sleep. We speak of the unconscious. The ancients spoke of the underworld. And he considered this underworld the abode of phantoms, much as we consider the unconscious to be the abode of psychological phantoms. In both cases, the term under is implied, a term which represents below the threshold. And the term threshold becomes very important in Babylonian thinking, because they established a clear concept of thresholds between the levels of the worlds and placed doors and doorkeepers there to guard the various planes or abodes of life. So we have, in this basic thinking, a state which precedes awaking, which precedes the dawning life consciousness of infancy, which precedes knowing and yet is the root of knowing. Thus, in the Babylonian concept, we come to a belief or an idea that reposing within the infinite nature of this darkness, this inevitable unconditioned, there were three duads or polarized beings that rested and continued and endured through all time and eternity, and that periodically these beings seem to waken, seem to move from subjectivity to objectivity, and as a result brought creation into existence as an emphasis, as a polarization within themselves. The Babylonians did not go as far as the Hindus in this thinking. They did not actually say that creation was the awaking of these gods. But they implied that creation was the manifesting of the will of these polarized pairs of beings who caused to emerge from the eternal the roots and substances of existence. Now, their philosophy comes back to us in the Orphics, and in nearly all religions where you have an anthropomorphic or polarized concept of existence. The eternal, unconditioned profundity caused a polarization to occur within itself. And this polarization became the abstract potential of opposites, although these opposites themselves did not have any factual existence at this remote time. As the Greeks had ether and chaos to strive together, so the Babylonians and Chaldeans conceived of a striving opposition, two qualities in stress one with the other. And this stress appears to be the old familiar pair that we just mentioned, namely the stress between an internal psychological creation and an external environmental and material creation. Thus, the stress arises at first as a polarization between internal and external, a polarization between subconscious and conscious. And this polarization took place within the substance of the unconscious. So the primordial triad of the Babylonians was essentially unconscious, subconscious, and conscious. And the unconscious remained and must always remain unchanged. And the subconscious and the conscious became polarized within it, the subconscious leading to a motion of life from within energy and out into form, and the conscious leading to a reaction or the gaining of experience or knowledge from living, from environmental association. Thus the universe consisted of two polarized powers operating upon each other, a power of withinness and a power of withoutness or outsideness. And everything that exists was molded either from within or from without. And in many instances, both procedures were identically occurring. So that we have beings growing inwardly and at the same time being conditioned outwardly. Now the primordial form of this being that came out of the abyss is without very much clear definition even in the Babylonian consciousness. Perhaps it is very much like the being we find in the Scandinavian mythologies, the giant Ymir, who is formed of the strivings of the frost giants and the flame giants in their great abyss, or the great mysterious cosmic uterus called Gnungagap, or the cleft in space in which life and manifestation must take place. Now this formation of a strange primordial giant, a giant of potential force, striving and eternally existing, seems to tell us that gradually subjectivity was objectified, probably in its earliest and most natural form, as a complete chaos of elements, as the invisible defied analysis, so the visible in its primordial form also defied analysis. It was a mass of unconditioned, undirected energies and forces, and it lay long in space, sleeping, a mysterious, mythical monster. And it remained unsouled or without life within it except this strange, seething, collective life of total being. And this was the shadow. This was that which was the objectification of the deep. It was primordial ignorance arising from the totality of primordial unknowing. Now we have to study these thoughts rather carefully because they function on so many levels simultaneously. It would be very easy to confuse them. Man did not conceive of space, total space, as having a mind. He considered it as having merely a total existence. When this space objectified into the total material concept of space, it also was without a mind, but with an existence or a subsistence, second only to the duration of eternity itself. The only difference between spirit and matter, then, in this conception, is that matter was destructible, because it could be returned again to its own primordial source, whereas spirit or being could not, because it was still that source itself. So the universe passed into a series of conditioned states. And in these conditioned states, gradually the objectification of the world began. It began as a series of strange, mysterious pressures, motions, impulses, surging and seething within being itself, and so abstract and so total that even the greatest mythologist did not dare to give it any very tangible definition. He did not even dare to name it. He merely implied that it had always been there. Now this primordial space element began gradually to seem or to become real as the first conditioned existence. It was the first apperceivable state. Man cannot perceive the unconditioned, but he can perceive the conditioned. So with the coming of condition, universality died in the experience of man, and man psychologically transferred his attention to that which he could understand or conceive, with the result that the ancient way, the original material, the base of being, faded from his consciousness to remain always known and recognized only through its symbolism in man, his own total unconscious. But this conditioned being in the Chaldean state, which was a primordial chaos, became known as the Elos, as Berosus tells us. It was the primordial slime. It was this same primordial substance that in the Indian philosophy is churned in the early avatars of Vishnu. This strange, mysterious mud, the slime, the base of our word Ilium, which is the ancient name for the city of Troy. This primordial mud, or ooze, was the great mother of all living. And way back in those days, man had begun to sense what was later to be more or less demonstrated, namely that all forms came out of water, and that all the organisms that were to come forth and become living creatures upon the earth had their roots and beginnings in a primordial ooze or slime, a humid earthy condition, a confused earth water mass. And that from this gradually came the beginnings of monsters. Now, on the psychological level, the helium, or the illus, the slime, became associated with the human subconscious, differentiated out of the total unconscious of man's existence. This strange ooze was the mother of imagination and fantasy. And it was from this internal strangeness that the first rudimentary dreams or nightmares of human consciousness began. So all human thought, all consciousness, all sensory and faculty differentiation, all ways of knowing and feeling which man has, came from a primordial kind of sensing, a mysterious confusion of thought and emotion, prior to the individualization of either. So that somewhere there was a strange common denominator of man's psychic origin. And this was the mud, the elus of the true subconscious root of conscious knowledge. From this subconscious came forth many different types of beings and creatures. And in the Kabbalistic and Chaldean Babylonian theology, it is said that from this slime or ooze, there came forth a phantasmagoria of creatures. incredible monsters that have no resemblance to the creatures we know in the world today. Composita of various kinds, human beings with the heads of horses, men with the legs and tails of scorpions, human beings with the heads and wings of birds, great flying monsters, crawling things with wings like griffins, innumerable, incredible creatures with many heads and many arms and many legs. All of these monstrosities crawling out of the mud, which was the common uterus of matter. A fantastic concept of lives and forms that were before the beginning. Now, out of this also, there emerged from within man himself, from the subconscious ilus of his psychic mystery of slime, mud, there crawled forth the beginnings and rudiments of man's psychic pressures and tensions, his various forms of awareness, his psychological ways of thinking and being, the first monstrous struggle of thought and feeling, locked in a death struggle for supremacy, the strange delusions of which there are still traces today. And in the midst of these, like a magician, standing as sorcerer over all this world of fantasy and magic, the necromancy, ruled the strange deity Enlil. This being, as the word Lil in the name implies, means demon. And the word Lilith, in relation to the story of Adam and his demon wife, implies not only a monstrous or evil creature, but by the demon a dream, a nightmare, a strange and horrible fantasy. And Enlil became the symbol of this subjective psychic life of man, inwardly breeding monsters, even as the Elos or the material slime gave birth to monstrous forms. Thus incredible creatures, creatures having no true substance in reality, have their inner life issuing from the subconscious slime of the invisible world and forms the strange patterns of the laws which were sometime to generate bodies and bring them forth in order and propriety. These laws, not yet having been established, forms grew in strange and fantastic and incredible ways. Now in this combination of things, we also see certain traces of our own psychology. We say it's a terrible thing to imagine or even try to think of a world ruled over by these seething, incredible reptilian bird creatures that represented ungoverned and uncontrolled thought. But let us see how quickly the same thing can happen in the mental life of the individual. When man is unable to control his mental emotional forces within his nature, he produces terrible fantasy, morbid dreams, monsters, of which the incubus is but a good example. Man fills his invisible life with nightmares the moment he loses his rational integration. So the Chaldean may not have been so wrong when he implied that if man, relaxing the control of his mental and emotional life, becomes the plaything of monstrous intensities, so in all probabilities these monstrous intensities preceded the establishment of control. and that at some time man was struggling for the integration of his own egoic consciousness, just as nature was struggling to discover the laws by which its own formal development could be brought under order and integration. So in the beginning, there was this tremendous struggle for integration, a struggle that went on and on, according to the old story, for vast periods of time. A struggle in which these monstrous forms reached out but could not survive, that they possessed no power of order within themselves, and that if they had remained as they were, the world would have gone on and on and on forever, and there would have been no growth, no consciousness, no integrity established in the entire structure of the world. Now, as time passed and these two processes, one subjective and the other objective, continued, we find a gradual unfoldment of theology. We find the gradual recognition or the establishment of the need for an integrated concept of being. In this great struggle, something had to take over. Something had to become the leader. Because these two forces, equally differentiated, would have struggled forever, ending only in chaos. Then it was, according to the Chaldean concept, that the ancient ones, the mysterious ones who had gone before, gods of an older order, are supposed to have come in and taken over and made these things gradually take shape. And in among and dominant with these gods came the deity Ea. Now Ea was the old one, very ancient, and Ea represented not the element of air. That isn't it. The deity's name is E'A, and it represents a very ancient being, a being that is supposed to have lived silently and eternally in space. Now, perhaps, if we study psychologically again, we can get some concept of what might have occurred or how the ancient believed it occurred. Out of the struggle of man in infancy to gradually integrate a mental and emotional being, this struggle gradually seems to lead to something. For in the development of things, a consciousness which has been locked behind the struggle gradually emerges, takes over, and integrates the mystery. This consciousness taking over from within seems to impose upon the great diffusion of chaotic forces a kind of law and order, and to demonstrate or prove that residing inevitably in being itself is also the experience of its own integration. And that when this struggle, when this slime of the ooze produces a certain degree of fantasy, gradually this fantasy leads to its own awakening. Just as man, under psychotic pressure, is ultimately pressed on to the restoration of his own integrity. The restoration of law and order within consciousness is first recognized as necessary, as the opposite to the existing chaos, and gradually it comes into manifestation. In any event, Ea was the deity who first of all dreamt and envisioned the organization of the world, and who bound the subconscious faculties of man into the service of an ancient principle that had always existed. In other words, the emergence from total consciousness, or as we might call it, the total unconscious, was in two waves or manifesting cycles. First, a chaotic, in which a psychic form, the seeds of thought and emotion structure, were projected. Then from this unconscious there also came the power of directional will, which ensouled both mind and emotions and brought them into order. At the same time, in the material world, the riot of forms which had resulted from the lack of control, this riot of forms gradually took a total picture, producing out of its own internal and eternal nature a terrible monster which was called the dragon. So here we have a God ruling supreme over the universe. And we have the dragon, a strange, horrible monster, consisting of the total integration of chaos in matter. For all of the strivings and the madness of chaos had also finally come into a kind of mass or a kind of common unity. And this unity was the primordial being against which the great Saint George must go to slay the dragon of chaos. So the problem of the establishment of the adversary, the evil power, came in the integration of the concept of the dragon. And this dragon, Tiawa, abode in the depth of things and remained constantly howling against law and order, against the gods, and insisted upon its own unconditioned, uncontrolled existence. Now the deity, Ea, then called upon the gods to go and reason with the dragon and to cause the dragon to renounce its authority and to become once more a servant of good. In other words, the gods were sent out to attempt to arbitrate with natural phenomena in an effort to bring matter and mind into agreement, that matter might accept the controlling power of mind-will, and that the divine imagination and reason might begin the molding of the material substances into the forms suitable for the incarnations of the godlings. But the dragon merely howled and refused to be in any way controlled. And so we have an interesting problem. If you remember in Genesis, day and night were created before the sun and moon, which is a peculiar circumstance. But the gods in the Chaldean and Babylonian account occupy the same position exactly. Ea, or day, was created before the sun. And the dragon, night, became its adversary. Now, the dragon is always more or less guarding the sunset, which is of course the goal of the Nibelung. And in the Nordic mysteries and in practically all the religions of the world, there is a dragon. And this power represents night with its dangers and its hazards, and sleep, during which imagination and the psychic energies of man escape from the control of the reason. So in the daytime, man began to be a reasonable creature, but at night, his psychic life possessed him, and he entered a state of madness. And in the old records, this problem of day and night is so clearly and wonderfully set forth that its psychological implications are very obvious. In any event, however, Ea, the deity, was unable to reason with this monster, this horrible creature that is usually represented in Babylonian art as a lion-headed, winged human being with a ferocious and terrible appearance, and often in mortal combat with the gods. So the deity who was at the root of life, the great thought which was organizing space, caused to emerge from his own being, as in the Greek myth, another god, who is generally referred to in the Babylonian story as Merodach. And this goes back to your Hindu, your Chinese, and your Tibetan concept, which is in the reverse of ours. Because in the Babylonian also, the thought gives birth to the mind. It is not the mind that gives birth to the thought. Thought precedes mind in the Babylonian Genesis. But out of the great thought comes forth the hero mind. And Merodach arises sometimes as Baal, sometimes as Beos, sometimes as Dagon in the Philistine form, and sometimes as Oannes, the fishman. But this Merodach is the only begotten of his father, the god who is destined and foreordained to bring order out of chaos. So he represents the symbol of universal mind, coming into the middle distance between the above and the below. In the ancient Babylonian art inscriptions, for in those days they carved their cuneiform glyph directly across their pictures, so that the body of deities and all these forms are covered with the little cuneiform characters. But in this writing and symbolism, we see Merodach descending into a middle distance between the abyss of space and the abyss of matter. And here standing in a luminous mist, wielding a great blazing sword of light, the sword Notum, the sword Excalibur, the mysterious sword of quick detachment of the Indian fable. And with this tremendous power, Merodach, blazing with celestial splendor, overcomes and destroys the dragon of darkness. And after the dragon of darkness has been slain, Ea, the god, rewards Merodach by making him the creator of the world we know. Now this is interesting because it indicates that creation, as we know it, is an entirely secondary process, and that Merodach becomes, so to say, the Logos in the same way that Zeus, the Greek Zeus, or the Latin Jupiter, becomes the creator of the inferior order of beings. In any event, Merodach, receiving power and authority from Ea, and therefore being entrusted with all things and all virtues and all natures, proceeds to take the body of the slain dragon, and from this body to fashion the entire structure of the mundane world. This is like the material universe formed or fashioned from the body of the snow giant Ymir in the Scandinavian rites. Or in the Greek, after Zeus has destroyed the 12 Titans with his thunderbolts, he fashions from the ashes of the Titans and the blood of Dionysus the human race. Now the titanic or primordial forces of the ancient Greeks are equivalent to the zodiac, and the great dragon coiled in space was the Babylonian equivalent of the zodiac, even as we find in Central America the signs of the star groups placed upon the back of the serpent in the case of the calendar stone. So from the body of this monstrous creature, mind, working upon matter, produces organized existence. And this organized existence is stationed in a kind of middle distance between the extremes of life and matter. And therefore, actually, Merodach is entitled to be called the formator, or the cosmocrator of the world. He is not the creator, in the true sense, because he does not create something from nothing. He is the formator, because he brings cosmos out of chaos by making use of the elements that have always been there. So out of all the primordial elements, the world is produced. And the world is divided into three essential parts. The lowest of these parts is physical nature itself, which begins to take proper form and kind. And the monsters disappear, and the horrible creatures vanish away. And those that have many heads and so on are no more to be seen, and the earth began to produce gentle bodies and types of forms that were suitable to the uses of mind, and these were originally called the mind-born forms, for they were generations of thought. In the meantime also, in the higher or mysterious subconscious chaos, an equivalent transformation was taking place. The dream world of nightmare and fantasy was vanishing under the light that shone from Merodach. And in the subconscious life of living things, mind began to take order. Reason began to assume power. Thought dominated fear. And man was no longer unable to face the mystery of darkness and of sleep. Mind began to give him the courage to organize, revise his own fantasies. So Merodach then turned upon the sleep monsters, the mysterious beings in space, and he slew all the evil gods in space. He slew, therefore, the forms of fear, of the hideous and terrible representations of imagination, of fantasy, and of guilt. He took all these horrible monsters of our dreamings and destroyed them, because the moment the mind integrated or became organized, it determined the nature of sleep phenomena. And man's sleep phenomena became merely reflective of his waking consciousness. And, of course, certain evil powers still remain, for the adversary is ever present. But Merodach took the world of sleep away from fear and gave it to reason. And by degrees, therefore, the reasonable world came into existence.